Welcome to the Federal News Update for Friday, October 10th, 2025. I am Alex Johnson, your guide.
I'm Sam Kennedy, here to help make sense of it all.
It's good to have you. And folks, we really need to dive deep today because, wow, the last 48 hours, arguably the most packed period for federal action, both home and abroad, that we've seen this year.
Absolutely. Packed is the word. We're looking at this really strange, almost unbelievable situation.
Our mission for this deep dive is to walk you, our listeners, through this incredible span of time. We've got this profound paradox playing out right at the heart of the U.S. government.
Yeah, on the one hand, you've got this crippling government shutdown. It's well into its second week now. It's grinding things to a halt, causing real, actual financial pain for hundreds of thousands of federal workers. It's a mess.
A huge mess. But at the exact same time, the executive branch has been, well, hyperactive, operating at maximum speed, it feels like.
Exactly. We saw the administration pull off a major, truly historic foreign policy win. They issued this just barrage of transformative domestic policy orders completely unilaterally, and they pushed forward with a really, really controversial political indictment.
So the key insight here, what we really need you to grasp, is that some of the most critical, maybe even legacy-defining moves happened despite the shutdown crisis, almost because Congress was paralyzed.
That's the core tension, isn't it? The executive branch showing, you know, exceptional competence on the world stage, the kind of thing presidents dream of, right?
Yeah.
Nobel Prize whispers already.
Right. While also, back home, taking actions that critics are screaming set dangerous precedents, using institutional power in ways that,
well,
that worry a lot of people.
Let's start with that big diplomatic win, the one announced late on October 9th.
You mean the Israel-Hamas Phase 1 accord?
That's the one. A huge deal. It came after two incredibly long, brutal years of conflict, a massive foreign policy victory for the administration. And significantly, it got the okay from Israel's war cabinet. That tells you something about the seriousness here.
It does. And the details. They're not just vague promises, are they? It sounds like a very structured process.
Yeah.
What does this phase one actually demand from both sides?
It's built around a really specific time-bound exchange, hostages and prisoners. So Hamas commits to releasing all 20 remaining living hostages, plus the bodies of 28 deceased hostages they've held.
Okay, and in return, what does Israel give up?
Israel agrees to release approximately 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. That's a significant number.
2,000.
Wow.
That's huge. And politically, that must be incredibly sensitive. Who exactly are we talking about in that group?
Oh, it's definitely sensitive. And the composition is key. That 2,000 includes about 250 individuals who are serving life sentences for various often violent offenses. And then there are another 1,700 who were detained since the October 7th, 2023 attacks.
So mix of long-term prisoners and more recent detainees. And how quickly is this supposed to happen?
Speed is crucial. Israel agreed to pull its military forces back from certain designated urban centers. They'll move to an agreed-upon line, basically, within 24 hours of the deal getting the final approval.
Okay, so IDF pulls back first.
Right, and then following that pullback, Hamas has a 72-hour window, 3 days, to release those 20 living hostages.
Given the history, the deep mistrust there, monitoring this, making sure both sides actually follow through, that seems like the hardest part. What's the U.S. role in making this stick?
You've hit the nail on the head. The U.S. role here is absolutely pivotal. It goes way beyond just brokering the deal. They're stepping into active monitoring and providing security guarantees.
Guarantees? Like what?
Well, first, the U.S. explicitly guaranteed Hamas that the kind of widespread, indiscriminate bombing campaigns we saw earlier wouldn't just resume the moment the hostages are out. Now, that doesn't tie Israel's hands completely. They still reserve the right to conduct targeted counterterrorism operations. But it's meant to prevent a return to massive shelling.
Okay, that's a major commitment from the U.S. What else?
Second, and this is really significant, the agreement sets up a U.S.-led civil-military coordination center. It's going to be based right there in Israel.
A coordination center? With American boots on the ground.
Well, personnel, yes. It'll be staffed by approximately 200 U.S. service members. But, and this is a crucial point, they're emphasizing that these are explicitly non-combat personnel.
Okay, so not trigger pullers. What's the job then?
Strictly monitoring, making sure both sides stick to the accord. And, maybe just as important, facilitating the massive flow of humanitarian aid that needs to get into Gaza. That aid distribution itself will be managed by the UN and other international organizations, but the U.S. Center helps coordinate the logistics and security for it.
So you have this incredible diplomatic success, this visible American presence trying to secure peace in the Middle East. happening at the exact moment the U.S. government itself is partially shut down back home. The contrast is stark.
It's the perfect political narrative for the White House, isn't it? This historic win immediately casts the president as this decisive, effective, global leader. And boom, right away you hear talk of a Nobel Peace Prize nomination. Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid even publicly endorsed the idea.
It paints the executive branch as competent, functioning, rising above the gridlock in Congress.
Precisely. While Congress looks completely paralyzed and dysfunctional.
Okay, so while one hand is brokering peace, the other hand, well, it seems like it was busy wielding the executive pen back in Washington. Leveraging the shutdown chaos, maybe?
Leveraging, exploiting. Depends on your perspective, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yes, simultaneously, the administration rolled out this massive domestic policy agenda, almost entirely through executive orders. And it wasn't a slow drip. It was a deliberate shock and awe strategy, all compressed into October 9th.
Shock and awe. Explain that strategy.
It means hitting multiple fronts at once. They unleashed this whole volley of significant policy changes: immigration, trade, defense symbolism, criminal justice, even architecture, all on a single day. The idea seems to have been to use that unilateral executive authority to the absolute max while Congress was tied up in knots, unable to legislate or push back effectively, overwhelm the opposition, maybe?
Let's unpack these EOs one by one, starting with the one that immediately got slapped with the pay-to-play label, the gold card visa program. What does it actually do, and how does it try to get around Congress's power over immigration?
Okay, this order sets up a new expedited path to an immigrant visa, basically, a green card fast lane. But it's for foreign nationals who make a substantial, quote, unrestricted gift, unquote, to the Department of Commerce.
A gift. How much are we talking?
It's very specific. $1 million for an individual applicant. Or if a corporation sponsors the individual, it's $2 million.
Wait, so you donate $1 million to Commerce and you get a fast track to residency. How is that legal? How can Commerce just grant visas like that?
Ah, that's the tricky legal part. And this is exactly why everyone expects this to be challenged in court, like yesterday. The administration is arguing that this $1 million gift can be sort of reframed. They're saying it serves as evidence of eligibility under existing high-skilled visa categories.
Existing categories.
Which ones? Specifically the EB1 category, which is for folks with extraordinary ability, or the EB2 category for exceptional ability or advanced degrees. The argument essentially is that donating $1 million demonstrates your exceptional value or extraordinary ability to contribute to the U.S. economy.
So they're defining wealth itself as extraordinary ability. That sounds like a real stretch. Bypassing Congress entirely on setting immigration criteria.
It's exactly that. It attempts to completely sidestep the normal legislative process, which is where Congress would typically debate and create a new visa category like this. Instead, it sets up a direct financial transaction as a pathway to residency. It's a really profound shift, basically saying money can buy you quicker access, and it does it without a single vote from the legislative branch. Major legal fights are coming, guaranteed.
Okay, next EO. A big move on trade, formalizing the new U.S.-Japan trade framework. What are the nuts and bolts here, and what does it mean for, say, consumers?
Right. This one imposes a pretty significant baseline tariff, 15%, on nearly all imports coming in from Japan. It's broad.
Nearly all?
Yeah.
Are there any exceptions?
Yes, a few specific carve-outs, things like generic pharmaceuticals, certain chemical precursors needed for drug manufacturing, and some natural resources that the U.S. considers critical or doesn't have enough of domestically. But for most goods, that 15% tariff applies.
And what did the U.S. get in return? Because tariffs usually mean we pay more for imported goods, right?
That's the trade-off. Japan committed to two big things. First, funneling $550 billion into U.S. investments over the next 10 years. Second, a commitment to significantly increase their purchases of American stuff, specifically agricultural products and commercial aircraft.
So it fits the administration's protectionist playbook, aiming to cut the trade deficit.
Absolutely. It's textbook protectionism, explicitly designed to shrink that bilateral trade deficit with Japan. But the likely consequence, as you hinted, is that American consumers are going to see higher prices, especially, experts predict, in the automotive sector. Japanese cars and parts are huge here, and that 15% is likely going to get passed on.
Okay, tariffs on Japan. Then there was this really symbolic one, reviving the Department of War title for the Pentagon. What's the point of that?
Yeah, this one is purely about messaging, symbolism. It fits perfectly with the administration's whole peace through strength mantra. The EO does two things. First, it immediately authorizes the Department of Defense to start using Department of War as a secondary official title. So you might see it on letterheads or something soon.
A secondary title. So not replacing defense entirely yet.
Not yet. The second part of the EO directs the Secretary of Defense to come back within 60 days with recommendations for permanently renaming the department. So this is step one towards potentially ditching defense altogether.
It feels like a very deliberate rhetorical shift, moving away from that post-World War II idea of defense and back towards something more. Well, Marshall. More assertive.
That's exactly the intention. It has zero immediate impact on how the military operates, but it's designed to project this specific image of readiness, of assertiveness, maybe even aggression to both our allies and our potential adversaries. It's branding, essentially.
Okay. And the administration didn't stop there. They also took a direct shot at state and local criminal justice reforms with an EO targeting jurisdictions that have eliminated cash bail. How does that work?
This one uses the federal government's biggest lever, money. The power of the purse. The order directs the Attorney General first to make a list of every city, county, or state that has, quote, substantially eliminated cash bail.
Okay, make a list. Then what?
Then the hammer falls. The order mandates that all executive branch departments and agencies must suspend or even terminate federal funding and grants going to those listed jurisdictions wherever they can legally do so.
Suspend federal funding?
Yeah.
Like grants for police departments?
Mm-hmm.
For community programs?
Potentially, yes. Any federal funds flowing to those areas could be on the chopping block if there's a legal hook to pull them. This is a major, major federal intervention into what's traditionally been state and local policy, how they run their court systems, and pretrial detention.
How much power does the federal government actually have to dictate state criminal justice policy like that? Seems like a states' rights issue.
That's exactly what the legal challenges will argue. This is expected to face immediate, fierce opposition based on the 10th Amendment and principles of federalism. Can Washington use funding as a club to force states to adopt specific better policies? That's the core constitutional question here.
Wow. Okay, one more from this EO blitz. This one seems almost aesthetic. The classical architecture mandate.
Yeah, this one definitely stands out. The EO establishes classical architecture, you know, columns, domes, traditional designs as the, quote, preferred and default style for all new federal public buildings, courthouses, federal offices, that kind of thing.
Preferred and default. Does it actually ban other styles?
It doesn't explicitly ban them, but it goes pretty far. It mandates that agencies have to give substantial consideration to redesigning existing federal buildings in the classical style whenever they undergo major renovations. It's basically saying we want everything to look like ancient Greece or Rome.
So it's an official rejection of modernist, brutalist, or contemporary styles for federal buildings, imposing a very specific traditionalist taste.
Exactly. It's a clear statement in the cultural policy arena. It views the look and feel of federal buildings as reflecting certain traditional American values, and it uses executive power to enforce that specific aesthetic vision, explicitly pushing back against decades of architectural trends.
Five huge EOs. Mm-hmm. Immigration, trade, defense, justice, architecture, all hitting on one day while Congress is shut down. That's a lot. But maybe the single most politically explosive action on October 9th was from the Justice Department.
You mean the indictment? Yes. The DOJ secured a federal grand jury indictment in the Eastern District of Virginia against New York Attorney General Letitia James.
And let's be clear about the context here. This isn't just any state AG. She's a prominent Democrat. And critically, she's the one who successfully prosecuted that high-profile civil fraud case against the president's business organization just recently.
The political context is impossible to ignore. That's absolutely right.
So what are the actual charges beyond the obvious political fight?
The indictment includes one count of bank fraud and one count of making a false statement to a financial institution. It all centers on a mortgage application she filed back in 2020 for a property she bought in Norfolk, Virginia.
Okay, a mortgage application. What's the alleged crime?
Prosecutors claim that James falsely stated on the application that this Virginia property would be her secondary residence. The allegation is she did this to get better loan terms, a lower interest rate, maybe lower down payment requirements. It's a fairly common type of allegation in bank fraud cases involving property flips or investments.
And how much money are we talking about? What was the alleged benefit to her?
The estimated financial gain, according to reports on the indictment, was relatively small in the grand scheme of things. Around $19,000 saved over the entire life of the mortgage due to those allegedly better terms.
$19,000. Okay, so the alleged financial crime itself seems modest compared to the political earthquake this is causing. Walk us through the timeline and the circumstances that have led critics to immediately cry weaponization of the DOJ.
The sequence of events is really what's fueling the outrage. This indictment didn't come out of the blue. It followed months, literally months, of the president publicly and repeatedly demanding that the Justice Department investigate and prosecute Attorney General James.
Okay, so public pressure from the top. What else?
Then there's the issue of who brought the charges. The indictment was secured by the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, Lindsey Halligan. And it's widely known that she is considered a political ally of the current administration. She was appointed relatively recently.
And didn't her predecessor have a different view of this case?
That's the critical point. Her predecessor was a career prosecutor named Eric Siebert. Reports indicate that Siebert was effectively forced out of his position just weeks before this indictment came down. Why? Apparently because he and several senior career attorneys in that same office had reviewed the potential case against James and concluded there wasn't sufficient evidence or legal grounds to actually bring charges. They reportedly thought the case was too weak.
So let me get this straight. Public demands from the president, career prosecutor who finds no case gets pushed out, political ally gets appointed, and then boom, indictment secured on charges the previous team deemed insufficient.
That's the sequence that critics are pointing to. And it looks, well, it looks highly suspect to many observers.
What was the reaction from James and other Democrats?
Immediate and furious condemnation. James herself called it a baseless and politically motivated weaponization of our justice system and pure political retribution. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer echoed that language, calling it a dangerous abuse of power.
So, regardless of whether there's any technical merit to the $19,000 bank fraud claim, the process itself, right, the appearance of political influence, that's what erodes trust here.
Absolutely. It sets a really chilling precedent. When the immense power of the federal government's law enforcement apparatus is perceived as being deployed specifically to target political opponents of the president, it fundamentally undermines public faith in the impartiality and independence of the Justice Department. That's a deep wound to the system.
Okay, so while all that political drama was unfolding domestically, the administration was also making some very practical, maybe even necessary decisions on the national security front. Let's talk about those Arctic security cutters.
Right. This is a fascinating example of where strategic reality seems to have overridden political dogma.
Oh.
The president signed a formal presidential memorandum authorizing the construction of up to 4 new Arctic security cutters. These are basically heavy-duty icebreakers. And the key detail, they'll be built in Finnish shipyards.
Built in Finland. But wait, isn't this administration all about Buy American? Building U.S. military and Coast Guard assets overseas seems to fly directly in the face of that core principle.
It absolutely does. And that's why they had to use a specific legal tool. They invoked a national security necessity waiver to get around those strict Buy American laws and regulations.
So what's the national security necessity here? Why the urgency to build them in Finland instead of waiting for U.S. shipyards?
The rationale is stark. The U.S. has a massive critical capability gap in the Arctic right now. Our current operational polar icebreaker fleet is, well, it's pathetic, frankly. We essentially rely on just 2 heavy icebreakers. One of them, the Polar Star, is ancient, commissioned way back in 1976. It's literally held together with spare parts sometimes.
Only 2. While other countries are expanding up there.
Exactly. Meanwhile, you've got Russia and China aggressively expanding their military and economic footprints in the Arctic. They're building new bases, deploying new ships, claiming resources. The U.S. is falling way behind in a region that's becoming increasingly strategic due to climate change opening up waterways and resources.
So the argument is we need these cutters now, and Finnish shipyards can build them much faster than U.S. yards currently could.
That's precisely the justification. The Finns have active production lines and expertise in building these types of vessels. The memo formalizes a deal, a memorandum of understanding with Finland, for up to 11 new medium icebreakers in total, worth about $6.1 billion. These first 4 built in Finland are the immediate injection of capability we desperately need.
Okay, that's the pragmatic part. But what about the America First politics? Is there anything in the deal to address that? Building ships overseas is still a tough sell domestically.
There is a compromise built in. The long-term plan, embedded in that MOU, includes a mandatory technology transfer provision. The idea is that the Finns will share their shipbuilding technology and expertise so that the remaining 7 icebreakers in the 11-ship plan can be built in U.S. shipyards.
Ah, so it's a phased approach.
Yeah.
Get the first few quickly from Finland, but then bring the production back home for the later ones.
Exactly. It tries to balance the urgent strategic need with the domestic, political, and economic imperative of revitalizing the U.S. shipbuilding industrial base. It's a pragmatic solution to a pressing national security problem, even if it bends the administration's own protectionist rules.
That kind of realpolitik seems necessary when dealing with Arctic competition. Now, shifting back to domestic security, the administration was also continuing to push its authority regarding those controversial National Guard deployments in U.S. cities, facing legal pushback. What happened there?
Right. The courts have really become the main arena for this fight. In Chicago, a federal judge actually issued a temporary restraining order. It blocked the administration from federalizing and deploying several hundred National Guard members, including those troops controversially brought in from Texas, whose mission was supposed to be protecting federal ICE facilities in the Chicago area.
And that came after strong objections from the governor and mayor, right?
Yes. Illinois Governor Pritzker and Chicago's mayor successfully argued, at least for this temporary order, that the deployment was an unconstitutional invasion. They claimed the administration was using relatively minor protests as a flimsy pretext to send in federalized troops without state consent, which they argue violates the Constitution.
And there was action on the West Coast, too, in Portland.
Simultaneously, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals was hearing arguments about a similar deployment of the Oregon National Guard in Portland. The legal questions there focused on what legally constitutes an insurrection or rebellion under federal law, the kind of situation that might justify overriding local authorities, and fundamentally, can the president just bypass the governor like that?
So, legal challenges mounting. How did the administration, specifically DHS, respond?
Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem basically came out swinging. She publicly stated that DHS is doubling down in both Chicago and Portland. They're not backing off. In fact, she said they're actively purchasing new buildings and hardening the security around existing federal facilities in those cities.
Doubling down. What's the justification?
She framed it purely as necessary self-defense. Protecting federal law enforcement and immigration officers who, she claims, are facing increasing threats and hostility instigated by local political leaders. So it's clear the administration sees this as a necessary assertion of federal authority over what they view as non-cooperative or even hostile local jurisdictions. The conflict is definitely escalating, not de-escalating.
Okay, let's broaden out again and look at the machinery of government itself. Even with the shutdown technically freezing appropriations, many core functions didn't just stop, did they? What was happening at places like the Treasury Department on October 9th and 10th?
You're right. Key enforcement and regulatory parts of the government kept humming along, often because they have separate funding streams or are deemed essential. The Treasury Department was quite active. For instance, OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, imposed a whole new round of sanctions. They targeted over 50 different entities, mostly companies and networks, that were helping Iran export its petroleum and petrochemicals. It's part of that ongoing effort to squeeze Tehran's finances.
So the sanctions machine keeps grinding. What about FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Unit?
FinCEN was busy too. They officially renewed their residential real estate geographic targeting orders, the GTOs. Now, for listeners who might not know, these GTOs are a powerful anti-money laundering tool. They require title insurance companies in specific major cities, think Miami, New York, LA, San Francisco, places with hot, opaque real estate markets, to identify the actual beneficial owners behind shell companies that are used to buy expensive properties entirely with cash.
So trying to pierce the veil of those anonymous LLCs buying up luxury condos.
Exactly. It's aimed squarely at preventing criminals, kleptocrats, and sanctioned individuals from laundering dirty money through high-end U.S. real estate. Those renewed GTOs took effect on October 10th. And on top of that, October 10th was also the compliance deadline for a different GTO, one focused on money services, businesses, check cashers, money transmitters along the southwest border. That one requires them to report cash transactions between $1,000 and $10,000, trying to track illicit cash flows related to smuggling and trafficking.
So Treasury's financial enforcement arms were definitely not shut down. What about the IRS? Most of their staff are furloughed, right?
The vast majority, yes. Taxpayer services are largely shut down, audits are paused. But even with most doors locked, the IRS still managed to perform one of its absolutely core, legally mandated functions. They released the official annual inflation adjustments for the 2026 tax year. You know, the updates to tax brackets, standard deductions, things like that. It shows that certain essential administrative gears have to keep turning, budget or no budget.
Okay. What about health agencies, FDA, CDC?
They were active, too. The FDA's key vaccines advisory committee held its scheduled meeting. They were tackling the really complex scientific task of recommending which influenza strains should be included in the vaccine for the 2026 Southern Hemisphere flu season. That kind of long-range public health planning has to continue.
And the CDC made a policy change.
Yes, a significant one. The CDC officially reversed its earlier, more cautious stance and issued new guidance recommending the COVID-19 vaccine for pregnant women, aligning with many other health organizations. This basically clears the path for more routine vaccination during pregnancy.
Now, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, we heard they hit a wall with funding.
They did. The EPA basically ran out of its carryover funds from the previous fiscal year, so they had to furlough most of their remaining workforce who hadn't already been sent home. But even then, certain legally required regulatory work continued. For example, they opened the public comment period for a final risk management rule on carbon tetrachloride, a toxic chemical. And essential field operations, like the ongoing cleanup of that big chemical fire site down in Louisiana's Tangipahoa Parish, also continued with essential personnel.
And the Defense Department, despite civilian furloughs, kept pushing forward on modernization.
That's right. The DoD's long-term projects kept moving. The Army, for instance, put out solicitations for a new, more adaptive version of its IBCS system, that's the Integrated Battle Command System, crucial for coordinating air and missile defense. They also moved forward with plans for a new robotic combat vehicle program. The wheels of major defense acquisition keep turning.
So if you step back, you really see the unevenness of the shutdown's impact, don't you? High priority areas like national security, financial enforcement, core legal deadlines, they find ways to continue. But the civilian workforce, public-facing services, environmental protection, they take the immediate full hit.
Absolutely. Which brings us right back to the source of the problem, Capitol Hill, where the legislative branch continued its spectacular failure to actually fund the government.
What was the latest vote count in the Senate? Still no progress on a continuing resolution, a CR.
Nope. The Senate held another vote. I think it was the seventh attempt to break the filibuster and advance a short-term funding bill, S-2882. It failed again, 47 votes in favor, 50 against, needed 60 to move forward.
So, 47-50. That vote pretty much guaranteed the shutdown continues into this week, didn't it?
Absolutely definitive. And what did the House do in response on Friday, October 10th? They held only a pro forma session, basically gavel in, gavel out, nobody there, signaling loud and clear they weren't even trying to negotiate or find a solution before the weekend.
And the political rhetoric around this failure just got nastier, didn't it? With leaders almost bragging about the shutdown.
It got really ugly. You had Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer telling reporters, quite bluntly, "Every day of the shutdown gets better for us." His calculation, clearly, is that the public blames the Republicans more for the pain.
And how did Republicans react to that?
Predictably, with fury. They accused Schumer of cynical political gamesmanship, pointing out that real people, military families not getting paid, federal workers facing uncertainty, citizens losing services are suffering while he sees political advantage.
And the White House wasn't just sitting back either. They came out with a pretty serious threat, right? Threatening permanent job cuts.
Yeah, they escalated significantly. The OMB director, Russ Vought, confirmed he was actively preparing to brief House Republicans on a plan to implement permanent reductions in force RAFs. That means mass layoffs, permanent job losses for federal employees.
Using the threat of permanent cuts as leverage in the shutdown fight.
Exactly. And the president himself doubled down on it, reportedly saying the administration will make permanent cuts and, adding a partisan twist, will only cut Democrat programs, turning the shutdown pain into a targeted, potentially permanent weapon against political opponents and their priorities.
Wow. So complete gridlock on funding the government, threats of mass layoffs. And yet, amidst all this chaos, Congress managed to agree on one thing, didn't they? Defense bill.
That's the most jarring contrast of the entire week. While they couldn't agree on a simple bill to keep the lights on, the Senate passed the massive National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, for the next fiscal year. We're talking $925
billion. $925 billion. And the vote wasn't even close, was it?
Not at all. It passed overwhelmingly, 77-20, bipartisan support. And this bill includes authorization for a nearly 4% pay raise for military personnel. It just shows you, when it comes to military spending, a powerful consensus snaps right into place, shutdown or no shutdown. In fact, the Senate actually recessed, left town after passing the NDAA, but before resolving the shutdown. The priorities seem pretty clear.
While the politicians score points and pass defense bills, the real costs of the shutdown keep mounting for ordinary people and services. What did we learn about the impact on air travel?
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy laid out some pretty stark numbers. Historically, maybe 5% of flight delays across the country are due to air traffic control staffing issues. Since the shutdown started, that number has skyrocketed to 53%.
53%, because controllers are working without pay.
Well, they're working, yes. Air traffic controllers are deemed essential, so they have to show up. But they are not getting paid during the shutdown. Morale is plummeting, staffing is strained due to uncertainty and financial stress, and the system is buckling. Secretary Duffy estimated the shutdown cost the U.S. travel economy $1 billion in just its first week.
$1 billion. And the financial pressure isn't just on those working without pay. Federal employees, even those still getting paid or hoping for back pay, got hit with some other bad news, right? Benefit costs are soaring.
This is a huge ongoing hit to the federal workforce's finances. The Office of Personnel Management, OPM, announced the health insurance premium rates for 2026. And they're jumping again.
How big a jump are we talking about this time?
For folks in the main Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, FEHB, which covers most civilian federal workers and retirees, the average enrollee share of the premium is going up by 12.3%.
12.3%. That sounds enormous. What does that mean in dollars out of a paycheck?
On average, OPM estimates it's about $26.40 more per pay period that employees will have to contribute. And remember, this comes right after a massive 13.5% average increase they absorbed just last year for 2025. So it's consecutive years of double-digit hikes.
And how does that compare to their likely pay raise next year?
That's the kicker. The president's budget proposed only a 1% average pay raise for general schedule employees in 2026. So you've got healthcare costs exploding by over 12%, while pay might go up only 1%. That's a significant net loss in purchasing power for hundreds of thousands of families. It's creating unsustainable financial strain.
And OPM, the agency that has to manage all these complex health plans and enrollment, they're facing their own problems, aren't they?
They are in deep trouble internally. Shane Stevens, an associate director at OPM, basically acknowledged this disastrous premium trend, but also highlighted that OPM itself is facing a massive staffing crisis. They're projected to lose about a third of their entire workforce, maybe 1,000 employees, by the end of this calendar year through attrition, retirements, and departures.
Losing a third of their staff. While trying to manage huge programs like FEHB and the new Postal Service Health Benefits, PSHB system.
Exactly. The agency's own inspector general has issued warnings saying this staffing exodus puts critical functions at risk. Specifically, the IT systems and platforms needed to manage open season enrollment, especially for the brand new PSHB program, are facing a significant risk of operational failure because they just don't have enough people.
So the agency in charge of benefits is itself buckling under pressure. We also heard about lingering problems from that deferred resignation program, the DRP, that was part of an earlier workforce shakeup. What's still going wrong there?
Yeah, the DRP continues to be a source of confusion and real hardship for many employees who took the offer. Remember, this program offered people paid administrative leave for a period if they agreed to resign at the end of it. But employees are still running into major problems.
Like what kind of problems?
Well, confusion over basic eligibility continues. But a big one is the rules around taking outside employment while they were on that paid leave. Did it violate the agreement or not? And crucially, the debt waiver part of the deal hasn't worked out as expected for everyone.
The debt waiver? I thought the deal was the government would waive any money the employee owed.
That was the promise, often interpreted as all debt owed to the government. But it turns out the waiver language in the agreements didn't actually cover every type of debt.
Seriously, what kinds of debt were excluded?
Things like outstanding federal student loans or recoupment of previous overpayments of salary or benefits. So employees who thought they were leaving with a clean slate are now finding out they still owe the government money and are being pursued for it, having to set up payment plans or face collections. It feels like a bait and switch to many of them, really damaging trust.
Unbelievable. And finally, on the workforce front, more instability at DHS with mandatory reassignments.
Yes, employees at the Department of Homeland Security are facing mandatory reassignments to different positions or locations, but there's huge uncertainty surrounding the process. Many employees who actually accepted the required move, agreed to relocate, still haven't heard back definitively about whether their relocation expenses will actually be covered.
They don't know if they'll get reimbursed for moving.
Right. The lack of confirmation suggests there might be funding shortfalls within DHS to actually pay for all these mandatory moves, which, again, forces employees into making life-changing decisions with massive financial uncertainty hanging over them, all during a government shutdown. It's just layer upon layer of instability for the workforce. But amidst this chaos for the workforce, the government's long-term focus on technology and, well, even space hasn't stopped. Let's shift gears to that, the push for IT modernization and the new space race.
Okay. It definitely seems like cybersecurity and modernizing federal IT systems remain a huge priority, shutdown or not.
They do, but the approach might be shifting slightly out of necessity. Jamie Crotts, who's the CIO for the House of Representatives, gave some interesting insights. He emphasized that for them, the journey towards zero trust cybersecurity is now seen as more process than technology.
More process. What does that mean practically?
It means instead of waiting for big budget appropriations for shiny new tools, they focused initially on getting quick wins. That involved things like optimizing the tools they already had and adjusting core internal processes, like how they provision new devices for staffers to improve security, and, crucially, save money right away by reducing technical debt. Be pragmatic, basically.
Be smart. So what's the next big hurdle for them in achieving full zero trust?
According to Crotts, it's the data pillar. This is the really hard part. It requires incredibly rigorous data governance. And for an institution like the House, that means figuring out how to handle unique, highly sensitive data types. The prime example is legislative data drafts of bills' internal analyses, which is protected by the speech and debate clause of the Constitution.
So figuring out how to classify, tag, and secure that kind of constitutionally protected information within a zero trust framework is a massive challenge.
Exactly. Developing the secure schemas, getting organizational buy-in on access rules. It's less about tech and more about complex legal and procedural agreements. That's their biggest remaining mountain to climb.
And looking more broadly across government, this idea of continuous monitoring seems to be becoming fundamental, right? Not just a nice to have.
Absolutely non-negotiable now, especially for resilience. Jason Warfield from Cisco Thousand Eyes made this point really clearly. Agencies rely so heavily now on complex ecosystems, cloud services, third-party vendors, interconnected systems. Continuous monitoring is the only way to ensure those services aren't just technically up, but actually performant.
And it helps distinguish between normal glitches and actual attacks.
That's a critical benefit. When something slows down or breaks, is it just an unexpected capacity issue? A configuration error? Or is it the first sign of a sophisticated cyber attack? Continuous monitoring provides the visibility needed to figure that out quickly, because how you respond to a system outage versus an active intrusion is obviously vastly different.
We also saw updated guidance from NIST on DNS security. That sounds technical, but why is it important?
It's actually a pretty big deal. NIST released Special Publication 881 Revision 3. This is the first major update to their DNS security guidance since way back in 2012. And it formally elevates the idea of protective DNS. It basically recognizes that DNS isn't just the phone book of the internet, it's a critical security control point.
Protective DNS, what does that involve? What are the key parts?
The new guidance really clarifies three core pillars. First, you have to secure the DNS protocol itself. That includes using encrypted DNS, which aligns with earlier White House mandates like M2209. Second, you need to secure the DNS infrastructure using dedicated hardened servers, not just relying on any old server. And third, you need to actively employ protective DNS. Think of it like a firewall specifically for DNS lookups. It actively blocks requests trying to reach known malicious domains used for malware delivery or phishing, stopping threats before they even get near the network edge.
Okay, sounds essential. But implementing that across the entire federal government, especially during shutdowns and budget uncertainty, that must be tough.
That's the exact challenge Chris Usserman from Infoblox pointed out. When agencies are operating under these endless continuing resolutions, CRs, the funding is unpredictable. Making the necessary investments to fully implement these critical NIST security mandates becomes incredibly difficult when budgets are tight and agencies don't know how much money they'll have next month, let alone next year.
Makes sense. And one last tech point. Generative AI. It seems like it's really moving beyond just experiments now.
Oh, it's definitely transitioning from pilot projects to actual production use in some significant ways. The Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, is a great example. They're scaling up a secure internal GenAI chat interface. The plan is for over 40,000 VA employees to use it on their internal network to help with research, drafting documents, summarizing information, boosting productivity for daily tasks within a secure environment.
40,000 employees. That's a serious deployment.
It is. And the General Services Administration, GSA, is also developing its own tool called GSAI. Their vision is to eventually offer it as a secure, compliant shared service that other federal agencies could potentially use. This whole trend is opening up huge new business opportunities for government contractors who can specialize in building, securing, and ensuring compliance for these AI tools within the federal space.
Okay, so from AI chatbots, let's leap to the moon. Literally. NASA and the Department of Energy made a pretty stunning announcement about putting a nuclear reactor on the lunar surface. By 2030, is that even possible?
Ambitious is an understatement, but they're framing it as an absolute necessity if we're serious about any kind of long-term human presence or colonization on the moon. James Walker, who's the CEO of a company called Nano Nuclear Energy involved in some of these concepts, put it bluntly. For long-duration stays, nuclear power is really the only option.
The only option? Why not just use solar panels? We use them on satellites all the time.
The moon is different. The big problem is the lunar night. It lasts for 2 full Earth weeks. And during that long night, temperatures plummet to incredibly low levels. Relying only on solar means you'd need absolutely massive, impractically heavy battery systems to store enough power to survive that 2-week darkness and cold. Nuclear offers continuous, dense power regardless of sunlight.
Okay, that makes sense. Continuous power. But a nuclear reactor on the moon, isn't that incredibly risky? What if it, you know, explode.
That's the common fear. But Walker and others stress that modern space reactor designs are fundamentally different from, say, weapons or even some terrestrial power plants. The fuel they use is not enriched to the high levels needed to create a nuclear explosion. They're designed for stable, continuous heat generation over many years with multiple safety redundancies. Safe, clean, long-term power is the goal.
And this isn't just about science, is it? There's a clear geopolitical angle here, too.
Oh, absolutely. This is 100% being framed as Space Race 2.0. The U.S. initiative is seen as a direct response to the joint lunar plans announced by China and Russia. They've signed agreements to collaborate on building their own lunar research station, including a nuclear power source, likely aiming for the mid-2030s, so the U.S. is trying to get there first.
And establishing power is the key to unlocking other activities, like mining.
Exactly. A reliable long-term power source on the moon is the fundamental enabler for everything else. It's the stepping stone needed to make ventures like lunar mining economically feasible. Think about mining for resources like helium-3, which is rare on Earth, but potentially abundant on the moon, and could be a fuel for future fusion reactors. That economic potential is the crucial long-term incentive needed to draw in private industry and sustain lunar development beyond just government-funded flag-planting missions.
Okay, so let's try to pull all these threads together from the last 48 hours. If you're listening, what we've really seen is this stark governing paradox on full display.
It really is striking. On one side, you have the executive branch demonstrating it still has this immense capacity for rapid, decisive, high-stakes action. The Gaza deal, the EO blitzkrieg. These moves are all driven by a clear doctrine of assertive, unilateral presidential power aimed at achieving long-term ideological goals, rewarding allies, and sometimes settling political scores.
And on the other side?
You have a legislative branch that is just fundamentally broken, incapable of performing its most basic constitutional duty, funding the government. And in its paralysis, it's actively inflicting real financial pain and logistical chaos onto the federal workforce and the public services they provide, creating deep instability for the very people trying to keep the government running day to day.
You can see the stress points cracking all over the place.
Definitely. The traditional balance of power between the executive and legislative branches feels like it's tilting, maybe dangerously. The independence of the judicial system is being openly questioned because of the perceived politicization of the DOJ. And the federal workforce itself is caught in this vice, squeezed between soaring healthcare costs and stagnant pay, facing layoffs and relocation nightmares. The foundations feel shaky.
Which leads us to the final, really provocative thought to leave you with after this deep dive. Think about this. Over these last 48 hours, the executive branch arguably achieved some of its most significant, most impactful policy and political goals. Things like the gold card visa, the targeting of cashless bail, maybe even the indictment of a political rival, precisely because Congress was paralyzed and unable to act or effectively push back.
If this becomes the new normal, if governance by unilateral executive decree enabled by legislative failure continues, What does that relentless centralization of power actually mean for the constitutional structure, for the checks and balances, and ultimately for the long-term stability of American democracy itself?
That is the crucial question hanging in the air. Something for all of us to think about as this shutdown continues and the executive actions pile up.
A lot to consider.
Indeed. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
Always a pleasure.